Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Tonight we are on paper 41, section 7, which is old single column, page 463. Okay, now, remember how we ended with the previous section. We, you know, the majority of the session was devoted to awakening us, I guess I should say, to a whole new appreciation of one of the 100 elements, the element calcium, and the truth that flows through that fact. As they got to the very end, they were making a transition into this section. And remember how they were commenting on, reminding us that to not forget when you're making spectral observations of stars, you are just looking at the surface regions. That light that you're receiving through a telescope somewhere is not coming from any great depth, into that star. I mean, basically, that layer of the star that we call the photosphere is the source layer for the light we see. Most of the star is inside of that, spherical level that is the photosphere. But then they made the comment, they're talking about this phenomenon. Let's read that last little bit there. They're talking about these iron lines, and they say this phenomenon is almost wholly due to the present temperature of the sun's surface, a little less than 6,000 degrees. Okay, and I mentioned that as we started into this next section, we would pick up that issue. And if you have ever taken an astronomy course or studied the sun or stars some yourself, when you're just reading up to that point and you see that 6,000 degrees, your thought would go naturally to a temperature that the astronomers call the effective temperature of a star, or the effective temperature of our sun in this case. And what that temperature is, as you can tell by the adjective they're sticking on it, it must not be something that's immediately related to the actual kinetic energy directly of the atoms, molecules that are rattling around in the gas, but it's somehow an effective temperature of something. Effectively, the temperature is this. Well, what does that mean? If you determine how much energy is coming from a star, and you make a basic assumption about the emission of radiation, radiant energy from a hot object. There's a very kind of basic foundational assumption of that. I don't want to go into the physics details. But there's a simple relationship of how things radiate in this basic foundational way, a simple relationship between how much energy the glowing object is giving off and its temperature. Okay? And so you determine how much energy is coming from the star, and then you just calculate the temperature that's associated with that energy, assuming it was radiating in this very sort of foundational, fiducial way. And you get this effective temperature. And that effective temperature for stars like ours, for our sun, is a little less than 6,000 degrees. And back in these days, you would have said 6,000 degrees Kelvin. You know, now we say 6,000 kelvins. And so when you see that, you go, oh, well, they must be, you know, I know that. So that's what they're referring to there. But as you roll over into this next section, they very quickly throw a monkey wrench in the works and tell you that that's Fahrenheit, not Kelvin or, you know, even Celsius, which is not too, you know, too far when you start talking about big numbers, away from Kelvins. It's in Fahrenheit. Now, in Fahrenheit, 6,000 is very different, sort of a temperature, and then you're confused. So the first thing as we get into this, this next section, is to deal with some of those issues and try to understand how they are, as best they can within the limits of the Revelation mandate, referring to what we understand and suggesting positive lines of investigation, further reflection, etc. As well as throwing in some really definitive, I know nothing about that information, you know, because it's something that we just can't know about. And so it's a combination. We have to very carefully pull this all apart and appreciate what it is that they're trying to suggest or reveal to us.
So what is 6,000 Fahrenheit in Kelvin?
I'll explain that when we get to it here in a second. Yeah. I'm going to leave you hanging. Because we're going to get to it in a second here. All right.
7. Sources of solar energy. The internal temperature of many of the suns, even your own, is much higher than is commonly believed. In the interior of a sun, practically no whole atoms exist. They are all more or less shattered by the intensive X-ray bombardment, which is indigenous to such high temperatures. Regardless of what material elements may appear in the outer layers of a sun, those in the interior are rendered very similar by the dissociative action of the disruptive X-rays. X-ray is the great leveler of atomic existence.
Go ahead and read that next little paragraph too.
The surface temperature of your sun is almost 6,000 degrees, but it rapidly increases as the interior is penetrated until it attains the unbelievable height of about 35 million degrees in the central regions. All of these temperatures refer to your Fahrenheit scale.
Okay, so let's start at the surface with that 6,000 number and then get penetrate down to the center, which is the main topic of what we're getting into tonight. But in the process, they're giving you this little aside about mentioning this so-called surface temperature. Okay, so to start with, remember as we were going along, especially when we got through that previous section talking about the calcium, and they gave us this information that we don't appreciate right now, that there's this very thick layer of gaseous calcium that is at the top regions of this sphere of matter that they've been referring to having a surface. And so it sort of added to this idea that you have a spherical system of motion where everything is coupled in a way that current science doesn't appreciate. But then outside of that, it starts to be more like we think of a gaseous state being where it's little billiard balls flying around with certain velocities, having certain kinetic energies that give you a certain temperature related to that kinetic energy. The faster they're flying around, the higher the temperature. Yeah. So that billiard ball model of it, you know, is above that quote-unquote surface. Okay, and remember how I mentioned that when they brought in the calcium and saying that, you know, that this this surface has a crust below it, essentially, you know, not literally a solid crust, but an effective, you might say, crust relative to calcium, building up because it's being pushed outward from the center of the star and building up in this thick layer below that surface. And then some of it's boiling off of that surface, you know, and going off into space. When they brought up that calcium, I remember I mentioned that going way back to the times when this was written, we had come to recognize that when you looked at the thin layer, relatively thin layer of the sun that's above the photosphere, it's called the chromosphere. You know, we were seeing calcium lines, you know, in there very definitively, and they initially referred to it as the calcium chromosphere. We were talking about that fixation on calcium that was in science back then, and how they were playing off of that and getting us to recognize the truth, even if it wasn't as simplistically factual as we thought way 100 years ago. Okay, so as you start to study that chromosphere, you discover that as you go up above the photosphere into that chromosphere, the temperature continues to drop. We've got some ability to figure out the vertical structure of the temperature, in these layers of the sun's structure, and we can tell that from the hot interior, the temperature is dropping and dropping and dropping. It's dropping through the photosphere. It's a range of temperatures in the photosphere span that effective temperature. But then it's cooler than that effective temperature by the time you get to the top of the photosphere, and then it keeps cooling as you go up into the chromosphere, and then it reaches a minimum up in there somewhere, we recognize, and then proceeds to heat up, and get hotter and hotter as you go above that.
Kind of like around the Earth.
We have these issues with the ozone layer and things like that, right? Yep, that make it so it isn't just a monotonically decreasing temperature profile. And so, we observed this, and we've been trying to figure out what that temperature minimum is there in the chromosphere, where we know there's these calcium lines that are very important for investigating that. And for a long time, we were thinking, well, maybe at the coldest, 4,200 Kelvin or something, maybe not even that cold, maybe 4,500 Kelvins. Okay, so let's answer that question. You were wondering, 16,000 degrees Fahrenheit, what is that in Kelvins? 6,000, what did I say, 60? Or whatever. 16. Okay, 16, I said 6, I'm sorry. 6,000 Kelvins, what is that? 6,000 Fahrenheit, what is that in Kelvins? See if I can get my brain straight here. And you notice that they keep pointing out it's a little less than that, you'll discover a little less than that in Kelvins is about 3,500 Kelvins. Okay, So the first thing, when you recognize it's Fahrenheit and you convert it to Kelvins, you get 3,500, you're going, wow, that's really different than the effective temperature. Apparently whoever wrote this book doesn't know what they're talking about. And they saw someone writing 6,000 and they didn't know that was Kelvins and they just assumed it was Fahrenheit. And wow, this is a really ignorant person. You can start in that mode. But then, you get, maybe not. It actually does get colder than that effective temperature, up in a kind of a surface area, even from our current perspective. But 3,500, that's maybe 1,000 Kelvins, lower than anything that anyone thinks. Well, by the time you got to the beginning of the 1990s, and they're continuing to try to get better and better at observing there, they started noticing temperatures that were colder and colder. And in the early 90s, there was even an observation that was made by looking at, it's cold enough there that you can actually have carbon monoxide. CO is not ripped apart by the temperatures, it's cool enough. If you've got a simple diatomic molecule, and they're looking at the spectral lines from that, and figuring out what temperature that corresponds to, and they got 3,500 Kelvins. Mm-hmm. Okay, just exactly what the revelators are saying here. So you can see that if you if you don't go off on false assumption tangents, if you just stick with, you know, recognizing that the people who wrote this are very intelligent, okay, and they know the difference between Fahrenheit and Kelvin.
They could have put it in Kelvin.
Yeah, they could have. But what they're trying to get you to appreciate is not only does it get that cold up there before it starts heating up and going into the corona above that, okay? Well, it's cold relative to millions of degrees, you know, or the millions of degrees in the corona, okay? Okay, it's cold relative to the corona, very cold. So, you know, they're trying to get us to appreciate that not only are there these very cold temperatures, but that coldest temperature, which is about a little less than 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, is where this surface is. They're trying to help us to understand where it is that transition is. And we notice, and it's not just like an arbitrary place where, you know, you have a monotonically decreasing temperature and you're just arbitrarily saying, here's the surface, which is like that effective temperature layer, you know, level. You know, there's no, like, change, you know, in the slope or something. You know, you're just going in this monotonically decreasing temperature with altitude and you're just arbitrarily saying, here's the surface of the sun, quote unquote. You know, there actually is a temperature indication of something physically different going on, you know, that the temperature reaches a minimum and then increases above that. And the revelators are trying to say that's not just because there's really hot temperatures below that and really hot temperatures above that, and there's got to be some point that's a minimum, you know, and it's no more significant than that. It's actually the surface. There's this surface. And inside of that, you have a more coupled system. Outside of that, you have a less coupled system. Okay, so that's what that's getting at. And the fact that we are zeroing in, although it's still, you know, in run-of-the-mill, people won't quote a number that cold. But, you know, it is interesting to note there are observations that aren't sort of fully accepted yet that do go actually to that exact temperature, okay? And then we didn't have them until the early 90s. You know, there was an observation like that. But you know, you're not going to see that if you go to Wikipedia, for instance. You know, it's going to be hotter than that for that temperature minimum.
So how did you figure that out?
I just researched it, figured it out, did some searching, and discovered that article. I think it was back in 94, if I remember correctly. It was back in 94, I think, when I discovered it. It was, you know, many years ago. So that's, you know, that's one issue, kind of the tailing off of what's been going on in the sections before this. All right, now zeroing in on the interior and the energy generation. That's the primary thing that we're going after tonight. All right, and it starts out with this, you know, the statement is the internal temperature of many of the suns, even your own, is much higher than is commonly believed. If you, you know, look up what the current, you know, estimates are with our current stellar and, you know, solar interior model, you know, the current estimate of what they think the central temperature of the sun is, and convert it to Fahrenheit, because they'll give it to you in Kelvins. You convert it to Fahrenheit, you indeed get a temperature that's a lot lower than the one they just gave you, 35 million degrees Fahrenheit. You'll get 28 million. Okay? And that's very, very significant difference in terms of even what we currently understand about stellar interiors. If they knew that the center of the sun was 35 million Fahrenheit, not 28 million Fahrenheit, you know, that would completely alter their rationalization scheme of what's going on in the center of the sun. And then they would really be confused about being able to match up their rationalization of what the interior of the sun is like compared to, you know, the output of the sun, what we observe. Okay, so that's a very, very significant difference, and we'll see it when we get to the beginning of the next section, really definitively. But just starting out with that, it is definitely very much bigger than the central temperature of our sun. However, the way the current rationalization scheme goes about stellar interiors, they think that really big stars have temperatures a lot higher than that. Okay, and we'll get to that issue here in a little bit. So when they say 35 million Fahrenheit, yeah, that's like, whoa, that's a lot hotter than we think the interior of the sun is. But, we easily think that a star could have 100 million, 200 million, 300 million, so 35 million, is not that big a deal if you were talking about a bigger star. And you notice what they said, the internal temperature of many of the suns, even your own, what we'll see they're getting to is, as long as you have the basic energy generation process going on in the center of the star, whether it's big or small, this is the kind of temperature you have. Obviously, if we're getting in the mode where we were talking about some before, where you have a star that's cooling and it's starting to solidify in the center and those sorts of things, okay, then that's different. And so that's why it doesn't say, all of the suns, but, all of the mainstream burning suns, that aren't super old or super young, okay, are going to be in this mode. They're not going to be quite a bit cooler than that, like you think. Like even your sun is quite a bit cooler, but some stars they think are a lot cooler than that, or radically hotter, like you think a lot of stars are. Okay, so that's very significant, very different than the current picture. So we shouldn't be surprised if that just obliterates the majority of the current understanding of how stars work inside, and how we rationalize why a star is, is bright and blue or dim and red or whatever. Okay. All right. Then the other thing that they were saying in that first paragraph is what we've been referring to some already. Remember how we were talking about the difference between ionized and shattered last time, and how you notice how they're using that again. We'll get into that in a little more detail here in a minute, but they're trying to get us to understand that we don't appreciate how severe that internal environment is for the basic integrity of atoms. The billiard ball model that we have doesn't suggest this. Okay. But if you have a system of motion like it really is, rather than a bunch of really hard little billiard balls moving around in space, there are avenues for it to be potentially more sensitive to disruption than we currently appreciate. I mean, they literally, imagine stellar interiors that get as hot as like 3.5 billion kelvins. Okay. And they can imagine that because, you in the current way of understanding a particle like an electron, the electron will still hold together in that environment. If you got up to 4 billion, okay, that's another story, but you can take it up sort of the limits of what we think the integrity of the particles are. The relativists are about to tell us that, no, at a much lower temperature than you would guess from the billiard ball model, like you are right now, those things begin to unravel. Okay? And this is just not even remotely appreciated.
So was this any source, you know, work that they got this from?
Well, I'll mention that a little bit. The things in here are playing off of a source work. It's that Architecture of the Universe paper, a book again by Swan. But you know, none of the important material is there. I mean, you know, if you get into the details of actually looking how they use the source work, you know, it's just delightful to see how they'll take something where the source author is talking about something totally different and they will use it, you know. It's like, well, okay, that doesn't really work for there. But we can use it in a totally different context. We can use that sequence of words, you know, we can use that number. Back in those early days, guesses of stellar interiors were all over the map, and it's kind of interesting that some of those early guesses were a lot hotter than this. So when they're saying that the internal temperature of many of the suns, even your own, is much higher than is commonly believed, they know where we'll finally settle on our belief, and our belief will be cooler than that, despite the fact that in the early years of the century, of the 20th century, you know, they might not have been cooler than that. You know, if you read various people trying to guesstimate at that, you know, in say the 20s and early 30s. Yeah. So, there's a very masterly use of you know what material we had and knowing where we would go. What false assumptions we would inescapably have, and what conclusions those false assumptions would lead us to, et cetera. And they're speaking to that, so that you know, it's valid today. Reading it. Yeah. Let's see. Okay, so and so you notice in there, regardless of what material elements may appear on the outer layers of the sun. Remember, you see that was like the outer layers they're talking to in the end of the previous section. Yeah. Again, this. They're trying to get us to stop extrapolating. It's like, well, we see integrous atoms in the surface, so they must go all the way to the center. It's like, no, you get in very deep at all, and it all starts to unravel in very definitive ways that we don't imagine is possible. All right, let's see, what else do we have there?
I have a question.
Okay, yeah.
You know, the X-ray thing.
Yep.
You know, they talk about the fact that it's not necessarily the heat that's breaking these things up, it's the bombardment of the X-rays, and they're indigenous to these high temperatures.
Right.
Does that mean they're created at these high temperatures, and being created, they actually, is it kind of like they also create high temperature by continuing to bombard, you know, sort of like a back and forth thing, and I'm a little confused as to that part of it, because...
Right.
You know, when I think of X-rays, I think of going in to get my CAT scan or something like that a little bit differently, and I don't
right, but
notice the high temperature aspect creating them, but maybe they are. And it's a different kind of X-ray, I'm sure. But
they don't generate those X-rays, you know, to take an X-ray of you by having a super hot plasma in the room next door, because that's kind of difficult. They use a different method. But if you have a very, very hot plasma, you know, it gives off X-rays. I mean, you know, the hotter you make it, the shorter the wavelength of light, you know, that hot gas plasma gives off, and you get it hot enough, and it's going to give off X-rays. So, you know,
an X-ray is
just okay. I mean, you've got visible light, and then shorter wavelength is ultraviolet, and there's kind of a whole range of ultraviolet, and finally you get really, really short, and you get to X-rays. You go even shorter than that, right? It's all, you know, we think of that as an electromagnetic spectrum that has radio waves on one end and gamma rays on the other end, you know, and it's all the same phenomenon, an electromagnetic wave. Radio waves have very long wavelengths, gamma rays have very short, and X-rays are short, but not as short as gamma rays. Okay, so, but shorter than ultraviolet.
So an X-ray is actually a short wavelength?
A very short wavelength, very high frequency, you know, in the current science, electromagnetic wave, okay? what, you know, next section, next paper, we get into that. It's waves in the force charge, actually, okay, is what they are. And the fact that what they actually are waves in the force charge, as I tried to say earlier when we were talking about X-rays in the stellar interior, the reason they keep referring to that is they want you to not even have as much of a particle-like sense as current science has attached to the name gamma ray. They want you to think more in non-particle-like fashion about this energy they're referring to, this very short wavelength energy, very energetic phenomenon, and that we've been saying, there are particles, but there's also force charge and waves in that force charge. You have a very chaotic system. Those particles are coupled to the force charge, and so it's like, you know, it all gets to a degree blurred out into just a giant ball of complex motions, and where the particle ends and the in between the particle begins is blurred, because in between the particles is filled with this very high energy kinking in the force charge. You know, think about it. If I put a really short wavelength kink in the force charge, that one little kink is going to act a lot like a particle. You know, if I can, instead of just having a upside down U shape here where I have a kink, what if I close my fingers together into a circle? Okay, now I have a particle. So you can see that if it's very short wavelength, there's a tendency for it to be a lot like a particle in its wave, wave crest per wave crest oomph.
So which comes first, the X-ray or the heat?
Okay, now there's heat because, you know, there's a thermal character to the whole thing. Particles are rattling around. They have kinetic energy. They have a velocity. So there's a temperature. There's a heat. Okay, but that's, you know, the heat thing. The heat is a secondary issue. The key is just that you have this system of motion of very high energy waves in the force charge, which we are calling X-rays, for simplicity. Some of them might be really high energy ultraviolet. Some of them might be very low energy gamma rays. But you know that's irrelevant. Okay, they're very high energy waves and particles, and it's all coupled together in a complex system. And because it's so coupled together, you know, the line is blurred between. You know, here's this sharp particle boundary, and it's very resistant. Well, what if there's stuff in between the particles? It's not just vacuum. That's just as dynamic. It's, you know, think of it like softening that surface. Okay, a surface that might be hard relative to vacuum. You know, billiard balls in a vacuum model, but it's not hard relative to something that is basically as hard but isn't a particle. The waves in the force charge are just as much momentum, just as much oomph to them, just as much hardness to them. Okay, and so it's kind of like you're melting the particles. See, you can think of the star as being kind of a ball of quasi-melted particles. They aren't as billiard ball solid particle-like. They're kind of melted, quote unquote. Okay, into the waves and the force charge between the particles. Okay? And you'll see in a second why I'm using that analogy of kind of thinking of it as not being little solids moving around, but more like a kind of a liquid kind of a thing. You see how they'll play on that analogy in a minute here. All right, so that's the idea that what's actually going on is an environment, an interior of a star is an environment where atoms are unraveling in a way we don't currently imagine that atoms could unravel. All right, and then they're going to speak to that. Yep, you got a question?
Yeah, so is it correct to think of it as, I mean, it's a dynamic phenomenon, but kind of a dynamic structure? I mean, does it have a I'm thinking in contrast to a dark gravity body where everything is coupled into a very the tightest structure you can.
Right. I mean, you basically. Right. I mean, you don't really have any in between there. A dark, you know, a dark island, you know, is like a solid crystal of automatons.
Right. Yeah. But the way you're talking, it sounds like there's no room in there. Like it's pretty tight.
Well, no, I mean, there is room. Remember, one of the things we talked about a while back, they reminded, you know, you can have a photon that works its way out, okay? I mean, a photon can't work its way out of the center of a dark island of space, you know, it's a solid, okay? You know, it's, you know, it is technically a gas. It's not a liquid, okay? It's technically a gas, and so, you know, and that's, you know, thinking of it like that, you can understand how something could go between the, you know, between things and get out, okay? It's just remembering that the in-between, especially down in the very center, is very vigorous, okay?
So, Chris, are there any beings in your estimation that are working with this, or is it just pretty much set on its own and then it acts in a mechanical?
No, remember, we mentioned that early on in this paper, that, you know, you've got the power beings are very much working with this.
Even
with a star like ours, it isn't encircuited yet. You know, we're going to get all this later in this section, okay? This is later in the section. But even a star that isn't encircuited and eternalized is being affected. And you're going to see that in this list we're about to read, too. They're going to refer to that. See, again, you see, just remember, we've said this a number of times, that, you know, every sentence leads to a million questions. And you just, you know, you can't answer all million questions with every sentence. You got to just let some things flow for a while, you know, and let a picture build up so that it has, you know, they're trying to set an organic context for answering questions. You know, and one sentence is not that organic context. You know, so me trying to answer every question, you know, I'm doing it in an inorganic way, and it's very unlikely that it's going to sink in.
Right.
You know, it's just going to go in one ear and out the other, or over your head, or whatever. Okay, so it's important to try to be present with this material. You know, but not totally. I mean, I don't. You know, you're allowed to ask questions, but just appreciate there's a balance. Okay. Enough questions to get you in, but not to get you all the way through, where you're dotting I's and crossing T's. Okay. All right. So that's the, you know, so they just start out with those two paragraphs. You know, there's a large paragraph break there. They're just setting that context, wanting you to kind of think about the things that you've read so far, get a little picture going. And now they're going to try to help you understand that a little bit more.
All of these phenomena are indicative of enormous energy expenditure, and the sources of solar energy named in the order of their importance are 1. Annihilation of atoms and eventually of electrons. 2. Transmutation of elements, including the radioactive group of energies thus liberated. 3. The accumulation and transmission of certain universal space energies. 4. Space matter and meteors, which are incessantly diving into the blazing suns. 5. Solar contraction. The cooling and consequent contraction of a sun yields energy and heat sometimes greater than that supplied by space matter. 6. Gravity action at high temperatures transforms certain circuitized power into radiative energies. 7. Recaptive light and other matter which are drawn back into the sun after having left it, together with other energies having extrasolar origin.
Okay, so as you were reading them, I think we'll actually start at the bottom and work our way up. Okay, so number 7 there, when we were, you know, like I mentioned, you know, they earlier talked about the photon escaping, you know, and then it might go for a great distance and then end up right back into a star again. Remember, we were joking about that. I'm free. Oh, I'm back where I started again. Remember, that recaptive light. Okay, so now, and that's 7, number 7. See, recaptive light and other matter, which are drawn back Okay, or that come in from outside of that star's, you know, immediate environment. Okay, that category is all of the very rudimentary electronic level phenomena. You know, like a photon, electrons, other, you know, small stuff. And that's in addition to number four. See, forward they say space matter and meteors. Okay, so space matter, gas and dust, and the meteors, rocks. Okay, so the combination of four and seven, you know, going all the way from you know, little electronic level particles, you know, up to things that are built out of those, like, you know, atoms in a gas, or dust grains, or rocks. Okay, so those are all of the kind of material, big and small, that we currently appreciate. Okay, and obviously if you're throwing that stuff into the star, you know, that can be consumed. It doesn't matter if it's just that, you know, little single particle of an electron or a photon, or a, you know, a big rock. You're just right, throwing coal in the furnace, you know, and you think of that very literally from our billiard ball sort of picture of things, like clods of coal. Okay, but notice, see, they split it up. The really small stuff is number seven. The bigger stuff, you know, is more significant. It actually, you know, can be number four. Okay, it's a lot of material that stars accumulate. You know, kind of like a giant vacuum cleaner, just vacuuming up all the gas and dust and rocks that are everywhere. And a lot of it, you know, may have gotten around the star because of the star's formation process, or like in our case, the formation of the solar system produced all kinds of debris besides the 12 planets, you know, and the sun is over time vacuuming all that stuff up again. Okay, so those two are pretty straightforward. So is number five, you know, which they point out might actually sometimes be four. You know, so four and five, they're telling you, are kind of equal significance. You know, and that one we certainly appreciate too. If a star is contracting, you know, it's going to give off energy. It heats up, gives off energy. Okay, just like, you know, compressing a gas. Just that simple understanding that we have, and you know, and scientists certainly appreciate that idea that you could get energy released through contraction. A simple example is our understanding of the planet Jupiter. If you study Jupiter, you quickly notice that it's giving off more energy than it receives from the sun. I mean, if you study the moon, well, it gives off as same energy it, you know, receives from the sun, basically, except what, you know, you know, may get absorbed a little bit and emitted at longer wavelengths, and you know, and you got to sum that up and whatnot, you know, but it's basically, you know, it's just, you know, a certain amount in and the same amount out. Might be spread out over more wavelengths than it when it came in, but it's basically just inequality. But you study Jupiter and it's giving off more energy than it's receiving. It's like, well, is it a star? Is it, you know, have some sort of energy generation process in the center? No, it's still contracting a little bit. Okay, yeah. You know, it's only been around for, you know, 4.5 billion years, you know, and so it's still contracting a little bit, and so, you know, it gives off some energy, like number five here. Okay, so that one too is, that's pretty straightforward and can be understood in a simple sort of a model, a gas of billiard balls contracting. All right, now number six, however. Gravity action at high temperatures transforms certain circuitized power into radiative energies. Okay, obviously we don't know anything about stars being in circuits. Okay, remember they mentioned, like I said, at the beginning of this paper, they brought in that issue that even if they haven't fully encircuited a star, stars are being utilized to set up the energy grid. Okay. anchor this the energy grid. And so they're pointing out that, and we mentioned at that time, it's like, well, there probably is some measurable consequence of that. If they're playing with them even a little bit, that probably affects them. Well, see, they're reminding you, yeah, it's low level, number six, but there is an effect. And if the star has actually been fully encircuited, number six is going to run up the list. I mean, that's going to become very significant. If they've really kind of plugged it in, they aren't just playing off of it, so that it's getting tweaked a little bit. But if it's really definitively plugged in, that's going to start to become a very significant thing. And exactly what the coupling is very mysterious. Gravity action at high temperatures. In other words, the whole issue of how this internal system works that you don't understand, it has a coupling with these sub-electronic level energies and stuff that they're gridding around the galaxy, and that is an energy input. Okay, in some mysterious way, just like they, will plug a non-breather, and the power beings, pump energy into them so they don't have to eat. Okay, it's the same, they're doing the same thing here with a star. They're pumping the energy in just such a way that the star, with its internal mechanisms, processes it and functions. Just like the non-breather takes that energy that's put in by the master physical controllers and processes it and uses it, in its metabolism.
Is this under the auspices of some of these power beings?
Right, this is the power beings. Yeah. Circuitized power, controlled by power beings.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, so that's the power being stuff there. Low level in a normal situation. Before the star is encircuited. Yep.
So when a planet or anything contracts, it's because the heat is going out and so it makes it go down.
No, gravity's contracting it.
So the universe is held by gravity from God, right? And then,
say what you're saying. What you're saying.
Gravity, like everybody's being pulled to God, basically.
But that's not the kind of gravity we're talking about.
So there's two types of gravity then. There's one that's bringing us down, like.
Right. We're talking about material gravity, here. That is taking things towards the center, okay? In terms of relating that to your personal experience, when they talk about you having a material mind and it's affected by material gravity, the contrast to that is the extent to which you have spiritualized that mind so that it feels some pull of spiritual gravity. You can literally visualize that as spiritual gravity lifting your spirits up, quote unquote, the way we talk about it, or material gravity dragging your quote unquote spirits down and you being depressed.
Oh, is that what that is?
Right. I mean, it literally is, that whole, you go manic if you're out of balance and spirit gravity is pulling you too high. Depressive if you don't have enough spirit gravity and material gravity is dragging you down too low. You're supposed to be in an equilibrium, not too high, and definitely not flying upward, and not too low, and definitely not falling downward. Right? You're supposed to be in a nice, stable equilibrium state.
We are unstable.
Okay, and people who are literally unstable, will oscillate. Between manic and depressive. They're just literally oscillating about their equilibrium point. Spirit gravity is pulling up, material gravity is pulling down. They're just oscillating. Okay, but here, we're just talking about matter. And we're just talking about this, this centering influence is wanting to crush things. But if it's, if there's an internal energy, that'll keep it puffed up against gravity trying to crush it. But if that internal energy generation decreases, then gravity is going to crush it a little bit more. And just the simple act of squishing a gas into a smaller volume heats it up.
Pressure cooker.
Right, right. Yeah. Why do you have a pressure cooker? Right. Those sorts of things, right? Okay, so, all right. So, so you can see that, except for number six, okay, the lesser ones are kind of straightforward phenomena from a current scientific perspective. Now, number three, is mysterious. the accumulation and transmission of certain universal space energies. Okay, and you notice they said energies, or the other one they mentioned power. Okay, when we're talking about the electronic level particles in 7 and the gas and dust and rocks in number 4, okay, we're talking about power. But what if you go sub-electronic? There's all kinds of sub-electronic level energy. It can get vacuumed up, okay, by a star. Okay, we don't even know that stuff exists, okay, let alone know that a star could be vacuuming up and using it in some way. But it uses it very definitively. It's number 3, okay? All that sub-electronic level energy, you know, is what they're referring to there in number 3, yeah, which is everywhere. Okay, so that's also,
are you referring to ultimatonic?
All the way down to ultimatonic. Anywhere from ultimatonic up to... Sub-electronic is, it's not just ultimatons, remember, it's a whole spectrum. You have collections of 100 ultimatons, that's the electronic level. But anything less than 100, all the way down to 1, is sub-electronic. Okay, and there's a whole physics there that they just allude to a little bit in paper 42, they don't tell you much about, but there's a whole physics to that. There isn't just ultimatons and then collections of 100, there's a whole range of stuff in between, okay? And it's going to play a huge role inside these stars. So obviously, you know, the stuff that's outside the star could be highly coupled to what's inside the star that's like that. Okay? All right, and it's very definitive. It's number 3. All right, so, you know, that's getting up to the level where that's going to be throwing off our ideas of how stars work. You know, the fact that we don't know about anything like that. We're going to have to try to rationalize all of number 3 with number 2. Number 2 is what we assume. Okay? Number 2 is fusion. You know, and if there's any fission too, you can throw that in. Okay? But it, you know, it's basically fusion, the transmutation of elements. Okay? We think that is the energy generation mechanism. You know, basically like converting hydrogen into helium, you know, through a fusion process. That's number 2. You're saying, no, that is not the. That's the second most important. The most important energy generation mechanism is something you'd know nothing of. Number 1. Okay? Where you aren't just playing with the billiard balls and making big billiard balls out of little billiard balls, you know, through a quote-unquote fusion process. Transmutation of the elements. Okay, you are literally unraveling things. Okay, and eventually, annihilation of atoms and eventually of electrons.
Is that referring to the X-ray thing, the paragraph above?
Okay, what we're referring to is regardless of why, the particles. Which and we're talking about not just taking an atom and thinking of it as a particle and ionizing it and, you know, quote unquote annihilating it. No, that's not what they mean. You know, that's a trivial issue of stripping electrons off. Okay, what if you actually start unraveling the nucleus? Oh, you mean ripping the protons and neutrons apart? No, there aren't protons and neutrons in a nucleus. You know. That's a single, very complex system of motion, that single particle in the nucleus. What if you start unraveling that? What do you mean unraveling? Yeah, we're talking about physics that doesn't currently exist. Right? The system of motion that is the nucleus can be unraveled. Even, you know, eventually, even the, you know, something as fundamental as that collection of 100 ultratons that doesn't have a lot of stuff added on like the nucleus does, but just a little bit added on, like just what gives it that charge. Let's say an electron, even that little particle unravels, okay? We're talking about the fundamental energy generation mechanism is unraveling particles, be they massive or not. Leveling everything down to, you know, obviously if you got some big, fancy, delicate construct like a uranium nucleus, it's going to unravel that thing till it's down to something, you know, very simple. like what we might call a helium nucleus or something. It's going to unravel it. You know, so without going into the physics, you know, think about the collection of 100 neutrons. Let's just be very simplistic. And you wrap, you know, ribbons or rubber bands around it. You know, and the more you wrap around it, the bigger the nucleus gets. Well, what if you go in there and just start, you know, unraveling those, you know, ribbons or snipping those rubber bands, you know, peeling, you know, you can, we all know we can make big balls out of rubber bands, you know. Imagine that you took your rubber band ball and started unraveling it down to a small rubber band ball. Okay, that's what we're talking about, that idea of unraveling these electronic level structures, even the most fundamental ones, okay? Getting right down to the base, where you've taken all the ribbons or rubber bands off the collection of 100 ultramatons, and you just have the collection of 100 ultramatons there bare. What if you unravel that? Maybe even into 100 ultramatons, free ultramatons, totally unravel it. Okay? That's what they're talking about.
So, if you take one rubber band off, that's transmutation of elements. That's going from a fatter one to a smaller.
The difference is, I mean, technically it's a similar thing, but they're differentiating because it's one thing to be thinking about taking a rubber band off of this one and putting on that one. You know, that's the transmutation, is shifting rubber bands around, you know, from one collection of 100 ultramatons to another one. Okay, it's another thing to you know, take the rubber band off and evaporate the rubber band. Okay, not transfer it to another billiard ball. Okay,
and that's the number one thing.
Okay, and see, if you're penetrating down below the electronic level, you're penetrating into a deeper level of motion, and those deep levels of motion are tightly coupled in and can get converted into electronic level energy that leaves as, you know, radiant energy of the star. You have this very deep well that science has no imagination of. And so instead of a star lasting at best billions of years with item number two, it'll last trillions of years with item number one. Okay?
So like with solar energy we're talking about. So you know how a virus and stuff or bacteria can be killed by heat?
But we're talking about something that is insanely more energetic than anything you can even imagine. Something, you know, the only thing that happens on a planet that's this energetic is when someone fuses. Okay? And that material body comes into direct contact with that pure energy of that adjuster, and that adjuster annihilates the atoms and even the electrons. The adjuster is so energetic, it unravels all of the particles of that body into free ultramatons. Okay? And it's not doing it in an environment where all of that energy can get turned into like heat, you know, electronic level phenomenon, because it isn't, you know, the dense interior of a star. It's, you know, but it's enough where they need to take you up in the atmosphere so you don't vaporize the city you're in. Okay. Right? Okay. That's what we're talking about. You know, even that phenomenon of doing it in a low density environment, you know, they have to take you way up in the atmosphere, right?
Okay. Where's my sunscreen?
So, you know, imagine what tiny percentage of that is actually getting coupled into the air, say, you know. I mean, all of it is coupled into, you know, down in the interior of the star. You're unraveling these things, and all of that energy, you know, is getting manifested, you know, in a form that gives you sunburn, okay? All right, so that's... So that's huge, okay? All right, that's, you know. And, you know, it's interesting if you study, you know, the human source work that they're playing with some, as we'll see, read a little bit further, you can tell when they're more definitively playing with it. But some of the things that are said in there, they're trying to, you know, play off as that. It's like, you know, you were thinking things a little bit more extreme, you know, in the early days, and then you kind of settled into this prosaic thing of just fusion. You were even thinking that it's, some of your initial estimates, you thought stars ought to be about a trillion years old, you were thinking. And then you decided, no, it's just fusion and they can only be billions. Oh, well. And then you re-rationalized things, you know, and decided that you were just off on a false tangent when you thought that they might be a trillion. And not only are they a trillion, but they're trillions and trillions, okay? You know, and it's because they're doing an annihilation thing even more than you can imagine. They're not just doing electronic level annihilation, which is E equals MC squared, that kind of annihilation. They're going even deeper than that. Okay, so you're not just going to get a trillion. You're going to get trillions and trillions. Okay.
Two is a distant second.
All right, two is a very distant second. Okay, and we think it's a supreme first. Okay. All right, let's read some more.
There exists a regulating blanket of hot gases, sometimes millions of degrees in temperature, which envelops the suns, and which acts to stabilize heat loss and otherwise prevent hazardous fluctuations of heat dissipation. During the active life of a sun, the internal temperature of 35 million degrees remains about the same, quite regardless of the progressive fall of the external temperature.
Okay, so two things in there. Again, in the process of talking about the interior, they reminded us of that issue we brought up earlier. Not only do you have that surface, you know, with a surface temperature and the chromosphere, but then there's that atmosphere, quote unquote, above that, the upper chromosphere and the corona, which not only is hotter, but way hotter, millions of degrees. Okay, right? And you know, current science is still trying to figure out why, how the corona is heated, you know, like that. It's very mysterious still today. I mean, they're getting closer and closer to thinking that they've rationalized it. But the very fact that the revelators throw this in here is a little reminder that you're going to spend a lot of time chasing, you know, things down rabbit holes. On this issue, look what they say. So there's this regulating blanket which envelops the suns and which acts to stabilize heat loss and otherwise prevent hazardous fluctuations of heat dissipation. Okay, even without going into any physics at all and trying to think about this more definitively, that's sounding to me like some manipulation is in play. So we probably shouldn't be too surprised if we have a hard time figuring out why it's hot. It may have something to do with like number six, or you know, it may have to do with power beings and over control. Them mentioning that is very similar, you know, and you notice you brought it up in the analogy of the ozone layer. You know, they mentioned that in the passing the same way, and you're going, no wonder we seem to have a hard time understanding exactly why it is that the ozone layer is maintained like it is. You know, because they point out that that's not a coincidence. That's part of the terraforming of a world, is to establish and maintain an ozone layer to protect life. You know, here we see it again, hazardous fluctuations. Hazardous for other stars, for planets, you know, gas balls like Jupiter? No. Hazardous for life. Right. Right. So, interestingly, see, both of them, there's a mystery there that you would expect to abide because there's power beings involved.
So when they destroy the ozone, what's going to happen?
So, in other words, should we panic that we could destroy the ozone? Are we more powerful than power beings?
No.
So stop hyperventilating. It doesn't mean that you should do everything you can to destroy it, just to test them. Okay? Let's see how evil I can be. To put God to the test. No, of course, that's, you know, that's not wise. But again, you know, the planet is managed by beings. And coincidentally, things will happen, you know, where life doesn't disappear.
Is that how we can just, like, walk outside when the sun's out there, but that's protecting us?
Right, if you didn't have the ozone layer, none of us could be outside. Yeah, because the ultraviolet coming from the sun would crisp us, you know? Right. I mean, a lot of that's chemically active. That's, you know, part of how the ozone layer works, because of the chemically active photons. You know, and you don't want those photons altering your chemistry, you know? It alters it a little bit and you get something called cancer.
Out there, we're protected by the ozone, but out there where all the stars and stuff are that are being eaten up by other stars, they don't have it there, right?
Right. If you need protection out in space for more than just, you know, having an enclosure to keep some air in to breathe. I mean, you know, this is the problem with going on a long space voyage. How do you protect yourself from all kinds of things? You know, you say, well, I can easily, I mean, a window protects me from the ultraviolet. I can just have glass to protect me from that. It's like, well, yeah, well, what's going to protect you from cosmic rays? That goes right through that glass, you know, et cetera. So there's, yeah, it's a very, and remember, we have no idea how energetic the local environment is. If we went outside of the bubble, the cocoon that the power beings create, it's called Manmasha, okay, you know, it's apparently extremely uninhabitable, right, outside of our solar system, outside of that protective bubble that they've established here. So
we have to go through there, don't we, to get...
Not in flesh and blood.
No, but I mean on spirit.
Not in flesh and blood, that's the issue.
But
not in flesh and blood. No. That's the whole issue. We're talking about something that's hazardous to flesh and blood, you know, to a corporeal being.
Not to a machine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a robust machine. And not to a spirit being.
So would you conjecture that the sometimes millions of degrees of this regulating blanket is getting some of that heat from the sun itself?
I mean, right now they're trying to rationalize how... Okay, so yeah, for those on the webinar, he's wondering about, you know, how the corona, you know, all that high temperature corona, is it coming from the sun? It's like, well, yeah, I mean, that's the way they're trying to understand it, is trying to figure out how some sort of a magnetic phenomenon is dumping energy into that atmosphere and heating it. And but the thing is, you know, this is probably going to all look very different once we have a totally different physics, you know, and you know, we don't understand a lot of these issues with the subelectronic and the force charge and all this and how this all works and all these mysterious energies they keep referring to, subelectronic energies and all this. So, I mean, I can't tell you exactly how to think about it, but the thing to note is initially just the truth of it. Before you try to figure out the fact of it, the truth is it's not an accident, apparently. You know, coincidentally, stars just happen to function like this, you know, because of sunspots or, you know, coronal mass ejections or something, right? You know, this is something probably quite profound, and, you know, it's an art form of some, to some, in some way.
Masterful
manipulation.
Okay. It's a true revelation.
All right, now, now the biggie, okay, the second half of that paragraph. During the active life of a sun, the internal temperature of 35 million degrees remains about the same, quite regardless of the progressive fall of the external temperature. Okay, and they're about to explain that in the next paragraph some more. But just start with that fact. That is not what you're expecting to hear. That there's some basically uniform central temperature regardless of whether the star is big or small, young or old, you know, within bounds, of course. But all of the main, functioning of a star, that at central temperature is always the same, a little bit hotter than yours, and nowhere near as hot as you think some O star or B star is, or something in its center, you know, some big blue or blue-white star. So that's, you know, from a scientific perspective, as you're reading, it's like, oh, that's interesting. Why would that be? Why wouldn't it work like we currently think, that if you got a really massive star, you know, it's crushing things really, you know, to a much higher degree in the center, and it's a lot hotter in the center. Why wouldn't that be the case, like we think? Well, let's see what they say.
You might try to visualize 35 million degrees of heat in association with certain gravity pressures as the electronic boiling point. Under such pressure and at such temperature, all atoms are degraded and broken up into their electronic and other ancestral components. Even the electrons and other associations of automatons may be broken up, but the suns are not able to degrade the automatons.
Okay. So the way this works, you start out, the star is young and collapsing and getting hotter and hotter in the core, and it finally gets to the point where you're unraveling the collections of 100 ultimatons. Okay, that quote-unquote electronic boiling point, you know, by electronic, you know, the ick part, you know, things like electrons, and you notice they even mentioned that, you know, even the electrons and other associations of ultimatons, you know, like, for instance, a photon, that's a collection of 100 ultimatons. That collection of 100 ultimatons, you know, like I was pointing out last time, that recognition that there's this fundamental particle foundation to the electronic level. Yeah, you can take those collections of 100 ultimatons with their electronic energy, and you can crush them and heat it up and heat it up. But what if you get to the point where they evaporate? Okay, then it can't crush it and heat it up anymore. See, there's a boundary temperature. It can't get hotter than that because the stuff that you're trying to crush and get hotter evaporates. Okay? Right. That's the electronic, that's the, you know, the unraveling of the collection of 100 ultimatons. You go, oh, wow, so if I just like converted 35 million degrees Fahrenheit into a, you know, a kinetic temperature, a kinetic energy, thinking of it like a kinetic temperature, you know, I could figure out if that makes sense of, you know, like, is that like in particle accelerators, are they smashing them together like that and evaporating? No, I mean, if you know anything about physics, you're going, that's way too low a temperature. 35 million is nothing. Now, if you were talking 4 billion kelvins, you know, forget about Fahrenheit for a second here, just if you take 4 billion kelvins, okay, now you've got something. But, you know, 35 million, which is like, say, 20 million kelvins? No. So they're going, okay, whoever wrote this doesn't even know any physics. That doesn't make any sense at all, that you could be unraveling something at such a low temperature as 35 million Fahrenheit. Okay, look at how careful they were. You might try to visualize 35 million degrees of heat in association with certain gravity pressures. Okay, and again, where was that? Under such pressure and at such temperature. Okay, you got to, you know, if it's this tightly coupled environment, then all it takes is that much temperature under that kind of pressure and that kind of super gas state of, you know, of material, that these things unravel. You don't have to get to 4 billion kelvins.
Yeah, the fusion machines, they claim to be at 100 million degrees.
Right, see.
So there's no way for us to duplicate.
right. I mean, you know, and not only can't we duplicate item number one, we've been trying for decades to duplicate item number two in the list up there. You know, and even trying to get what we think the interior of the star is, so that you can get, you know, fusion happening in a sustaining way. You know, we've spent billions and billions and billions on fusion power and, you know, gotten really nowhere. Okay. Right. To try to do number one, I don't know. Yeah, we're not going to have some little gizmo in the lab that's going to do item number one. We can't even do number two. Okay.
When the Isle of Paradise is in each of Ultimaton, that's why they can't be degraded. They can't degrade the Ultimaton because it's carried.
No, I mean the Isle of Paradise is at the center of every atom too, center of every electron. The integrity of the Ultimaton is we're talking about a finite process. And it takes a transfinite process to unravel an ultimaton. Okay, all the Isle of Paradise is doing is making the ultimaton spherical. Okay, it's not giving it really the integrity. The integrity was given to it by force organizers. They took the force charge of space, the primordial force, and they wrapped it back on itself in a little quantized way, a little individuated way, and made this tail-chasing, localized, spherical phenomenon that no finite process can unravel.
But an adjuster is transfinite. Why doesn't it unravel?
Doesn't want to.
All right, but the transfinite part of the adjuster is not penetrating down into the finite. It's above the finite. Remember that the adjuster doesn't even have a relationship directly to the finite until fusion, and that's so it's just the very, you know. Right.
I always thought.
Yeah, one second here.
Got a question. What and who is able to degrade an ultimaton, and what does it become?
Force organizers can unravel ultimatons and back into primordial force, if they wanted to. It takes an absentite being, no finite being or finite process or a finite influence from a transfinite being, you know, is going to do it. You had something?
About a year or two ago, whenever it was that we were talking about that, remember? Hmm. About the ultimate, the Isle of Paradise being in every ultimatum. Right. I remember it gave me some form of security knowing that God was there with us, and now, you know.
Again,
I don't quite understand that.
Right. I mean, Isle of Paradise is not God. If you want God, the influence of God to be at the center, you need a personal being, like force organizers.
Oh,
okay. You know, the God that made that integrous little thing, I mean, is not the Universal Father, the Eternal Son, the Infinite Spirit. It's Paradise force organizers, those super personalized beings, those hands of an infinite father are what made those little integrous phenomena. And they only have the kind of integrity that a being like that could give them. A co-absolute influence could unravel that ultimaton, but a finite influence can't. Yeah. So those, you know, they're coming from the top down and taking that absentite phenomenon of the force charge, and rolling it back on itself, and making this it's the most fundamental finite expression, but the finite expression is like the skin, you know, it's actually an absentite nugget, okay, and see, so you can't unravel it because the finite thing can touch the skin, but it can't penetrate the surface. It can't unravel it. It takes an absentite phenomenon to penetrate the surface. See, so it hasn't. It doesn't need Isle of Paradise integrity. It doesn't even need co-absolute integrity. An ultimaton just needs to be integrous relative to finite processes. So supernovas can't blow it, you know, unravel them or something. Okay, but all bets are off. You know. About anything higher. All right. Let me just say one more thing about that. I mean, the integrity that you're looking for from the aisle is, the aisle is making sure that each one of those ultimatons stays this, you know, spherical, localized phenomenon. It doesn't ooze out over here. You know, you don't want your body to ooze off over there. You want it to stay localized. Okay, the Isle of Paradise is making sure that every one of your ultimatons, and hence everything that the ultimatons are built out of, okay, stay localized.
Everything that's built out of
ultimatons. Did I not say it? Okay. Everything that's built out of ultimatons. Yeah, you know, stays localized.
I'm glad you...
Okay, so, right, you know, that's what we mean by that, you know, that integrity. See, but we're getting, you're looking for a philosophic integrity, and we're talking about the scientific issue, and that's separate. Okay. All right. Okay, so, see, that's the deal. Yeah, and they're trying to get us to understand is that there's an environment where things are unraveling in a way that you don't appreciate. This sort of stuff is going on to some degree, this kind of unraveling when, you know, in particle accelerators, you smash things together, you know, and we have all sorts of crazy rationalization schemes about quark gluon plasmas and all sorts of, you know, groovy things like this, but, you know, we could rethink all of that if we had a better physics. Okay. All right. So, 35, like I said, it's about 28 million Ferrars. See, about four-fifths, you know, that. And as I said, we get forward here a little bit more. That fifth is a big difference. The fact that not only our star, but all stars are not cooler or hotter, but are all right around that, radically alters the part of the physics that we do know so far, item number two. It has a huge impact on item number two, as well as, you know, being involved in item number one that makes it last for trillions of years. So I'll help you appreciate that a little bit as we get forward here. Okay.
These solar temperatures operate to enormously speed up the ultimatons and the electrons, at least such of the latter as continue to maintain their existence under these conditions. You will realize what high temperature means by way of the acceleration of ultimatonic and electronic activities when you pause to consider that one drop of ordinary water contains over 1 billion trillions of atoms. This is the energy of more than 100 horsepower exerted continuously for 2 years. The total heat now given out by the solar system sun each second is sufficient to boil all the water in all the oceans on your rancha in just 1 second of time.
Okay, now that last part, as you might be able to guess, sounds like it's out of a source work, and it is. I mean, giving those sorts of statements at the end there are definitely helping you to find the source work. Yeah, and like I said, the notice in the source work that one of the things that's kind of going on in those early days of speculating about solar interiors is they're not just thinking about item number two, but they're thinking about the whole E equals MC squared thing. They're thinking about something more fundamental, which is not really done. We don't think of a star as converting electrons and protons and neutrons into pure energy. We just think of it as item number two, fusion. Okay. They're trying to give you an on-ramp that gives you, you know, some helpful information for the novice to understand the energy levels involved, you know, by using horsepower analogies here and stuff, and how many molecules there are in a drop of water. You know, and you can see it's, you notice you've got 10 to the 9 times 10 to the 12 there, 10 to the 21. It's like, oh, that's pretty close to Avogadro's number of 10 to 23. Yeah, right. I mean, you do a quick little calculation about how much smaller, that a drop of water is than what would give you 10 to the 23, and you're going to get 10 to the 21, just like they're saying there. And you know, little idea of just how much energy is there, even if you did see what that author was thinking, what Swan was thinking, you know, what we can imagine with E equals MC squared, kind of unraveling in a sense the electronic level stuff. But now, just now that you know that there's sub-electronic, just extrapolate that. It's even more than that, okay? And it is going on. You know, you're not just stripping things down till you have nothing but electronic level bases left. They may be oscillating like a gamma ray or something. But you're unraveling even those electronic level bases, okay? And all of that motion, and it's all of that energy, is coupled into the system tightly in a way where it can produce radiant energy eventually on the outside of the star.
That drop model, that's just electronic base.
Right, that's just giving you an idea of how much, you know, just strip it down to the electronic level base, okay? And like I said, but it's, you know, it's even deeper than that. But see, they're reminding you of that. It's like, you know that there's a potential there. It's like, yeah, but it's not hot enough, you know, to even do that. Well, see, it doesn't have to be. If you actually know what's going on there, these things get unraveled even when you don't have 4 billion, you know, kelvins.
Yeah, if the pressure's
right. Right. Under the kind of environment, you know. See, and it's not just pressure. It's, yes, they did. But I mean, I'm trying to explain. It's not just pressure like we think of it. I mean, we think there's a lot of pressure in the center of a star, too. But see, it's a temperature pressure environment in a state of matter that we don't understand. It's one thing to think of that temperature and pressure in a gas of billiard balls. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a state of matter that we don't understand right now. And if you have that high pressure and temperature in that state of matter, that super gas, not just that billiard ball gas, things unravel. Okay, at a, you know, at 35 million degrees Fahrenheit. Okay. Let's see. What else is in there? You know, you just notice how they're sort of playing into the on-ramp, but tweaking it. These solar temperatures operate to enormously speed up the automatons and the electrons. You know, and they're, so they're throwing in the automatons, kind of like, okay, we have more billiard balls than in the current billiard ball model. But then they say, at least such as the latter, such of the latter as continue to maintain their existence under these conditions. And that reminder, it's like, you know, that's just something that is not imagined could be happening, that you could be obliterating electrons in the center of a star. All right.
Before you go on, I have a question about the 100 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
How did they determine what a horsepower is? Like, I know that's a stupid question, I'm sorry.
No.
How did they determine that? Is it
1,000 pounds? No, it's just, long time ago, they created a rough unit of, based upon, how much, energy per unit time a horse can generate, and created this unit, it's obviously, when you're just talking about an actual horse, it's not a very precise unit, So it's like a foot. A horsepower is like a foot. It's like, well, which foot are you, you're talking about my foot or your foot? Well, no, everyone knows a foot is a certain, right? It's the same way with a horsepower, okay? You just standardized a horse's power to a certain number of watts.
746.
Right, right. There's a number of watts, right?
Is that what it is?
Yes.
746
watts?
I'm not just going
to
say that.
Just like you standardized a foot to be 12 inches and not 11 inches or something.
So 746 with 100, and then you take for 2 years, or trying to envision that. What would that be?
we're talking some serious kilowatt hours here.
It's a bunch of kilowatt hours. Really big field of horses.
Yeah. Let's see, it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of a million, I suppose, kilowatt hours. It's probably something big like that. Yeah.
If you go to Home Depot and you find a 746 watt light bulb, you can say you got a 1 horsepower light bulb.
Okay.
There are some sodium bulbs like that.
Some sodium. That's a 1 horsepower sodium.
All right, let's not, we're not even going to get close to that if we get too far afield here. Let's keep focused here. That, okay, we got to remember, we're trying to just get started here, and then you can explore on your own. Don't try to do everything here in the context of the group.
Only those suns which function in the direct channels of the main streams of universe energy can shine on forever. Such solar furnaces blaze on indefinitely, being able to replenish their material losses by the intake of space force and analogous circulating energy. But stars far removed from these chief channels of recharging are destined to undergo energy depletion, gradually cool off, and eventually burn out.
Okay, see, so here they're pointing out that issue that stars can be directly plugged in, as it were, put into the direct channels, the main streams of universe energy. There is no subsequent evolution of that star, leading to eventual stone cold cinder death after trillions and trillions of years. And you see how they're referring to that phenomenon that we're dealing with the subelectronic level domain, the force charge and the analogous circulating energy stuff that's closer to that force charge than the electronic level. Like I've said over and over many times, when you think about this energy grid in the cosmos, it's fundamentally a sub-electronic level energy grid. There's not this beam of electrons or something, going across space, that you've stuck your hand in and it'd be vaporized like that. It's these energies that we currently have no recognition of their existence. Sub-electronic stuff. It's not that that sub-electronic stuff doesn't have any consequences. The sub-electronic energy environment that we're in right now is active enough and coupled enough to atoms, that no atoms bigger than 83 can hold together. They get torn apart by it. Anything bigger than bismuth, lead's 82, bismuth is 83. Anything bigger than lead and bismuth gets torn apart by the subelectronic environment. Well, you can imagine if you went outside of the little cocoon of Mamasha, if it's that energetic even inside, that all 100 can't hold together, you go outside and probably it's a lot smaller than lead that, is torn apart. Quite a bit smaller, probably. So just that appreciation that, what elements are radioactive and which aren't, is a function of the environment. That's completely unrecognized, in current science. And we'll get to that more in paper 42. This whole issue of exactly what they're referring to here, how you're supposed to precisely understand how a star is plugged in like this, obviously is completely beyond anything we can comprehend right now. We're having a hard enough time just trying to bring some sort of amorphous subelectronic into our picture, let alone all the physics of it, and the art of it, right? Okay, is there something on the webinar?
Isn't 1 billion trillions of atoms somewhat confusing terminology? What is billion trillion?
Like I said, they're seldom going to try to use one of those designations. What is that? That's I mentioned it in the passing. So a billion is 10 to the what power? 10 to the ninth, right? Million six, billion's nine. Trillion is 10 to the 12th then, right? So 10 to the ninth times 10 to the 12th. One step at a time. 10 to the ninth times 10 to the 12th. Okay, how do you multiply those two? You add the exponents. 9 plus 12 is 21. Okay, it's 10 to the 21. Right? That's just a way of not using more technical language. Instead of going into quadrillions and quintillions and sextillions and septillions and octillions, they do that occasionally. Remember, they did 2 octillion tons back here. Right? But a lot of times, it's easier to just keep it simple and say 1,000 million, say, or something, expressions like that.
Real quick, sort of kind of off the topic. Have we sent any spacecrafts outside of Malaysia?
Right, we've got, the Voyagers are heading out, and see, so this is... Right, and so there's all kinds of interesting things that we might observe. That radioactive generator that keeps that spacecraft going, you wonder how that might be altered if radioactive decay rates change and stuff like this. The thing is, if those sorts of things happen, no one will, will understand what's happening. All right, let's see here. That's the basic thing. This is just the spot where they really definitively, tell you about how stars can be, plugged in like this and shine on forever.
Don't worry about our sun.
Right.
We're bound to become light and light before that happens.
Oh. Right, you don't have to worry about the sun going through some... You don't have to worry about the sun going through some sort of a decay process. It will be in-circuited. And right now, as we were reminding, it's being manipulated right now. Okay.
It lives for trillions of years anyway.
All right. All right.
Such dead or dying suns can be rejuvenated by collisional impact or can be recharged by certain non-luminous energy islands of space or through gravity robbery of nearby smaller suns or systems. The majority of dead suns will experience revivification by these or other evolutionary techniques. Those which are not thus eventually recharged are destined to undergo disruption by mass explosion when the gravity condensation attains the critical level of ultimatonic condensation of energy pressure. Such disappearing suns thus become energy of the rarest form, admirably adapted to energize other more favorably situated suns.
All right, we're going to read about that a little bit in the next section. Remember, with the power beings, there are actually power beings that also work on unraveling stuff. If it's gotten too dead and out of, circulation, literally. But there are a number of quote-unquote natural processes, too, like they're pointing out, where those cinders won't just sit there for trillions of years. They'll get disrupted and recirculated in a number of ways. The consequence of what they're stating there is they're just reminding you that when you observe things in space, you're going to come across oddball objects that are involved in all sorts of combinations of sort of normal suns and little dark islands, collided together and whatnot. So they're just reminding you that there's just a menagerie of things out there. Stuff is rattling around and mixing together and, in all kinds of different ways. All right. I don't think we need to try to pick it apart any more than that, but just appreciate that they're giving you that information to try to remind the scientists that will be developing a science from this to to keep in mind all the different avenues that are in play. That you can't expect just a handful of ideas to rationalize all the stars that are out there. There's going to be some very oddball things. All right, let's do this little section here. This is a corollary. And let me say up front, okay, so this section we just read is, okay, here's what's actually going on. And in the running pattern in the Revelation, that's followed by, in this case, a whole section on, here's how you are thinking about it now, or starting to think about it now, and let's tweak that a little for you, suggest a little bit within that context for you, to add to the picture. Okay, so that's, you definitely want to understand them in this order, because there's things in here that if you have scientific training, you'll recognize. But you have to make sure that you put it in the context of it follows, you know, what preceded it here. I'll show you what I mean when we start reading.
8. Solar energy reactions. In those suns which are encircled in the space energy channels, solar energy is liberated by various complex nuclear reaction chains, the most common of which is the hydrogen-carbon-helium reaction. In this metamorphosis, carbon acts as an energy catalyst, since it is in no way actually changed by this process of converting hydrogen into helium. Under certain conditions of high temperature, the hydrogen penetrates the carbon nucleus. Since the carbon cannot hold more than 4 such protons, when this saturation state is attained, it begins to emit protons as fast as new ones arrive. In this reaction, the ingoing hydrogen particles come forth as a helium atom.
Okay, now, one of the things that's going on too in this section is they're playing with the things that we were just starting to figure out, including stuff that's post 35. I mean, some of this stuff probably was modified in this section, you know, right up until the last minute in that third phase of putting the Revelation together. So, you know, because we were discovering stuff in the latter half of the 30s and, you know, and into the, you know, 1940, 41, 42, like that. I mean, you know, that they're playing with here. So they're trying to take the very latest stuff that we have and try to speak to it a little bit. Now, for those who know about the current stellar interior theories, they will tell you that the primary type of fusion that goes on in the center of our star, our sun, is what's called the proton-proton chain reaction. And they believe that that's the dominant fusion process, taking hydrogen to helium, because of the relatively low temperature at the center of our sun. Then they'll tell you that if a star is hotter in the center, there's another fusion process to get from hydrogen to helium that involves carbon as a catalyst. And they call that the CNO cycle, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, because this cycle goes through carbon and nitrogen nuclei until it finally ends up back with the carbon you started with and 4 hydrogens getting turned into a helium. Okay, and going, oh, well, that's what they're talking about here. They're obviously talking about what we call the CNO cycle. And they're going, well, why would they talk about the CNO cycle? I mean, wouldn't they speak to our, you know, sun? Which, you know, this is a minor thing, the proton-proton chain. Yeah, like, you notice how they even use that. See, nuclear reaction chains, proton-proton chain reaction. You know, why wouldn't they be referring to that? Well, what did they tell you? They told you that the center of every star, including yours, is about 35 million degrees Fahrenheit. Once you get up to 31 million degrees Fahrenheit, the CNO cycle is the dominates over the proton-proton chain. They're pointing out that item number two there, because all stars are 35 million Fahrenheit at the center, is predominantly the CNO cycle, which you've started to figure out, you know, back here in the early part of the century, they're writing this. And it's, you know, previous part of the 20th century. It's not the proton-proton chain, like you'd be expecting me to talk about right here. Okay? So, that's, you know, they're pointing us away from what we think is, you know, really we think that most stars are just using a proton-proton chain. They're saying, no, most stars, all stars, basically, are using what you call the CNO cycle because they are hotter. Most stars are hotter than you think they are. You know, the majority of stars we think are a lot cooler than 31 million Fahrenheit in the center. There's only a handful of stars that are big, right, in relative terms, and we think are hotter. Okay, so that's what's going on there. That's why that is being featured and not the proton-proton chain. But the other thing they're doing there is also they're saying it away in a way to tweak it a little bit away from the billiard ball model, because we certainly interpret the CNO cycle as a billiard ball model phenomenon. They're not speaking about it like that. I mean, it sounds on the surface like they are. They're giving you the on-ramp. But the more you study it, the more it's like, wait a minute. Either this person doesn't know what they're talking about, or they're not saying this in the billiard ball way. You know, it sounds like when they say, since the carbon cannot hold more than four protons, so it sounds like, you know, you've got the collection of protons and neutrons, it's a carbon, and there's four protons, billiard balls going in. Well, even that, you know, you think about it one at a time. One proton goes in and modifies it, you know, to a different nucleus, and they think about it as a sequence. It's a cycle. Here they're talking about it kind of all at once, which is kind of mysterious. They're like, well, maybe they're just trying to sum it up. And then they say, when this saturation state is attained, it begins to emit protons as fast as new ones arrive. Then they say, in this reaction, the ingoing hydrogen particles come forth as a helium atom. It's like, well, which is it? Is it protons or a helium atom?
Bing, 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 bing.
Okay, we'll get to this in paper 42. They're taking our word proton, and they're generalizing it. They're using it more in a literal sense. They're not just using it as the name for that particle called that we call a proton, a hydrogen one nucleus. They're using it in the literal sense. It's the primary one. You have an atom. It's a collection of particles. There's one primary particle, the nuclear particle, and then the electrons around it. The proton is the primary one. You know, protos means first. It's the primary one. They're using that word proton, the central proton, the nucleus. They're using that to try to get you away from the billiard ball model. It's not a collection of protons and neutrons. It's one particle, the primary particle. Literally, the proton. Okay? In this case, that primary one is a helium nucleus. Okay? And the way they're describing that is sort of four in rather than one at a time and going through a sequence of nuclei and going around a cycle and ending up back at carbon. You know, like I said, you know, going through nitrogen and oxygen and ending back at carbon. Because they want you, if you think about it in a system of motion fashion, this is more appropriate. And see, even saying they don't call it the carbon cycle even, let alone the carbon-nitrogen-oxygen cycle, they call it the hydrogen-carbon-helium reaction. All of that is an effort to tweak it away from a billiard ball model into a recognition that what you actually have is you have a system where you have five particles before and five particles after. You have a carbon and four hydrogen hydrogen nuclei, five particles before, and after you have five particles, a helium nucleus, and four photons. The motion on those four protons, as we call them, gets protons. Those the
before
motion. Okay, I'll say it again, and then you'll get it. Okay, the motion on the four hydrogen nuclei, the four what we call protons, is transferred off, and then you're left with. Oh wait, did I say? Oh, I said four after it. I should have said three. I'm sorry. Okay, let me say it again. So you have four protons and a carbon. Afterwards, you have the carbon still. And the four particles, instead of being the four protons, are a helium and three photons. I said it incorrectly. Three photons.
Light.
Three photon particles. Right? You've stripped the electronic level motion off of the basically all of it off of the four protons, off of three of them, and put it on the other one, you know, and made the one into a helium nucleus. You know, leaving three of them just almost stripped bare, a collection of 100 ultimatons that just has an oscillation like a proton. Okay? That's what's actually going on there. And that's related to what you were kind of pointing out. You know, isn't there some similarity between one and two? Yeah, I mean, if you actually think about nuclear processes in a more motion, system of motion fashion, it's like, see, transferring the rubber bands, you know, from one base to another. You take the rubber bands off of three of them, basically, and put it all on, you know, on one of them. And left with three that don't have much in the way of rubber band anymore wrapped around them. Okay, they're stripped. Yeah. Okay. All right, so that's... So, see, they're taking what we know about the CNO cycle, saying, okay, and... You know, your whole rationalization of your sun, for instance, you know, where you understand everything about it with the proton-proton chain. No. I mean, is it surprising that when we measured the number of neutrinos coming from the sun, based upon our assumptions about how it generates energy, that we didn't, you know, get the correct number that we should have gotten? No, because the interior, I mean, forget about item number one. We don't even understand what's going on with item number two because we have the temperature totally incorrect. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So this is why the more we started investigating this, the more it didn't match up when we started having to kludge things and... Yeah. All right. And then on top of it, if you want to actually understand a nuclear process, you know, it's different than the billiard ball way of rationalizing it. Okay.
Reduction of hydrogen content increases the luminosity of a sun. In the suns destined to burn out, the height of luminosity is attained at the point of hydrogen exhaustion. Subsequent to this point, brilliance is maintained by the resultant process of gravity contraction. Eventually, such a star will become a so-called white dwarf, a highly condensed sphere.
Okay, quickly, two things there. And if you read this from current perspective, you go, oh, they seem to be talking about just what we understand, things going to red giants, finally cooling down to white dwarfs. Okay, the problem is that whole process we understand is involving fusion above fusing hydrogen into helium. You know, we start fusing helium into, you know, and bigger things into yet bigger things. You know, at ever higher temperatures, no, none of that occurs. All you've got at 35 million Fahrenheit is hydrogen into helium via the hydrogen-carbon-helium reaction. Okay, And so they're saying you need to even rethink all those ideas. You know, it's kind of, the basic is sort of there, but the whole process involves just hydrogen to helium and contraction and expansion into a red giant and things like that. And I don't want to go into all the physics of that, but that's, they're mentioning it because, see, they want you to remember that you've got to rework all that because you don't have the current avenues of rationalization, because you're not going to get hotter temperatures than 35 million Fahrenheit. So you're going to have to totally rethink how that works. And you have to do it just with hydrogen to helium and, of course, item number one, all that sort of stuff. Okay. But the other thing here is, remember how when they were first pointing out to us that we have everything backwards when we're thinking about the ages of stars, and they mentioned what appeared to be white dwarfs before. They said, the collisional dwarfs may be very young and may glow with an intense white light, never having known an initial red stage of youthful shining. And you're going, oh, they seem to be saying that white dwarfs are actually really young and not really old things. Totally the opposite. Oh, it comes back around here. Now, here they actually use the expression white dwarf, not collisional dwarf. And they're saying, okay, there actually is a thing that is white, glowing white, and is old, but not all of the things that you're calling white dwarfs are actually white dwarfs like this. See, that's what they're getting at. Is they're trying to point out that you're going to have, there's a confusion there that you're going to suffer from.
How do you differentiate?
Right, that's the whole question. See, then you've got to figure out how to differentiate. See, there's a whole scientific investigation that has to go on. They're trying to just give you the data points. You know, right now we think, well, the only thing like that is what results from a cooling and contraction like this. And so we're rationalizing every little white thing that way. They're saying, no, some of them are like that, but not all of them. It's like, well, that's confusing. Yeah. So this is what they're doing. She's just touching upon little things, giving you little grounding points, showing you where there's some measure of correctness to what you're thinking right now, but only a little measure.
Not much.
Okay, just the beginnings. You know, and you definitely need to kind of go back to the beginning of the 20th century. Start with the little tidbits of truth that you had and rework it again, because all the rationalizing you've done in the last 100 years is not valid. Okay? All right. And then what happens, remember how they mentioned in the end of the previous section where something might collapse in a catastrophic way, you know, and, you know, blow automatons back out into space, where everything can start all over again. They're going to mention that.
In large suns, small circular nebulae, when hydrogen is exhausted and gravity contraction ensues, if such a body is not sufficiently opaque to retain the internal pressure of support for the outer gas regions, then a sudden collapse occurs. The gravity electric changes give origin to vast quantities of tiny particles devoid of electric potential, and such particles readily escape from the solar interior, thus bringing about the collapse of a gigantic sun within a few days. It was such an emigration of these runaway particles that occasioned the collapse of the giant nova of the Andromeda Nebula about 50 years ago. This vast stellar body collapsed in 40 minutes of Urantia time.
Okay, so just mentioned the last part there. Okay, so they're talking about a supernova. They're talking about the supernova that occurred in 1885. You know, see, 50 years before 1935. It occurred in 1885. First supernova we observed outside of the Milky Way galaxy. The only one we've seen in Andromeda, you know, which is in the first outer space level. They're giving you that wonderful little fact point to hang, you know, to work with, that it giving you a collapse time, a specific collapse time.
Wow.
You know, so that would be handy for scientific development. All right, so that's the basics of what they're just referring to, that supernova. Now, the other thing that they're doing in there is, okay, starts out, see, talking about these great big giant supergiant stars that, you know, in many ways are more like a small circular nebula than they are a star, you know, because you have this atmosphere just puffed up into this big nebula-like thing, you know, that's the size of the orbit of Mars or something, right? And so they're reminding you that it's, you know, that it's not like you have that tightly coupled sphere of motion that's that big, right? You know, it's kind of more like a nebula now than a star. All right, so there's that, and then they're referring to, so, you know, if it's so thin that you know, the radiation pressure is, you know, the radiation is just escaping. I mean, gravity's trying to crush this thing, you know. An outward force of that pressure gradient is keeping it, you know, from collapsing. I mean, but if you release that, the thing is just going to catastrophically collapse, okay? And when it does that, we appreciate this. You get a supernova, you get a flash of electron neutrinos that come out of there. That's what they're referring to there, and they're talking about, you know, they have to refer to them the way they do because they didn't, you know, modern terminology wasn't there yet. But when they talk about those runaway particles, see, those vast quantities of tiny particles devoid of electric potential, they're talking about an electron neutrino, what we call it right now. And an example of us observing those electron neutrinos coming from a supernova and getting here before the light did from the supernova is when that supernova went off in the Large Magellanic Cloud in 1987. You know, we had neutrino detectors for the first time on the planet, and we observed the neutrinos coming from that. If I recall, I think it was like 2 or 3 days before we saw the light from that supernova for the first time. See, and that's what they're talking about. See, those just, you know, go right out. How do they readily escape, as they say? See, whereas it took a while before the light was, you know, heading off in space. So the neutrinos get here before the light does. And we observed that for the first time about 100 years, almost exactly 100 years after this supernova, 102 years later, we observed that exact effect.
So the Andromeda Nebula that we observed that's still out there today, this is just part of it that went
through? No, one star.
A one star.
One star out of
in the nebula
out itself. Of trillions. Okay. Yeah. And it took us a long time, but we finally have tracked down the remnant, the needle in the haystack. okay, so that
But that's a million years. They said that somewhere else. That's about a million light years.
Yeah, away. A little less than a million light years away. Yeah.
So that nova thing that we just observed happened a long time
ago. Right. Right. Yep. And see, all they're doing, in many ways, they're validating those ideas that we have fairly definitively now, to a degree. But they're, you know, throwing in things like the gravity electric changes, you know, and mysterious statements like that that are referring to some way of talking about the system of motion, you know, and how you should think about those electron neutrinos coming into existence and stuff. So, you know, that's all kind of vague. Until we work out this new physics, you don't, you know, you won't be able to appreciate exactly why they're saying some of those things like that. Yep.
Well, that is not the same thing as they're talking about in the earlier at the end of the first section, is it?
What did you say?
Well, this process that I just described of a supernova. That's not the same process.
Oh.
The end of supernova.
Okay, yeah. How that relates to what it says there at the end of the previous section, when they talk about by mass explosion, when the gravity condensation attains the critical level of ultimatonic condensation of energy pressure.
That's different.
No, that's the same thing. We mentioned that earlier. That's why I didn't repeat it there. As this thing is collapsing, you know, it's unraveling everything, but it can't unravel the ultimatons.
Right.
Right, so you get down to where it's going to try to start to unravel an ultimaton, and it's going to ricochet off of that, bounce off of that. You know, so this incredible implosion, you know, that whole massive star collapsing in 40 minutes. Okay, this stuff is screaming downward. Okay, you know, octillions of tons, right? It's screaming downward, you know, and then rebounding off of those immutable ultimatons. Right? That's what so it's the same process. And unlike the other supernovas they mentioned, see, these don't involve some sort of a binary system. And see, like I mentioned, we have two basic types of supernovas that we think some are a single star and some are related to binaries. And I was pointing out, see, they're trying to help us to understand, yeah, there's some truth to that. These ones that we think are singles, they are. They're confirming that. Okay, but they're giving it in this context of, you know, we don't think of things rebounding off of ultimatons and stuff like that.
No, don't even recognize ultimatons.
Okay. But we do understand that there's going to be all of this, these electron neutrinos generated, and like I said, we've even measured those now, and so they were telling us these details long before we measured that.
Isn't the present myth that these things collapse in on themselves, and then of course. Then they go into a
blackout. Okay, we're going to talk about that next. Yeah. Okay, let's read this last paragraph and I'll speak to that.
As a rule, the vast extrusion of matter continues to exist about the residual cooling sun as extensive clouds of nebular gases. And all this explains the origin of many types of irregular nebulae, such as the Crab Nebula, which had its origin about 900 years ago. And which still exhibits the mother sphere as a lone star near the center of this irregular nebular mass.
And see, all this was, you know, like just as they were wrapping up the revelation that we were just starting to figure out the central star in the Crab Nebula and stuff. Like I said, this is all just very, very much in the, at the tail end of putting the revelation together, that they're synchronizing with things that we figured out. All right, so in 1054... is when that supernova, you know, went off, and the Chinese recorded it. And we eventually, during the time when they're putting the revelation together, we figured out that that nebula that we call the Crab Nebula is a supernova remnant, like they're describing here, that cloud of stuff, okay, that irregular nebular mass, which it is, it's not a nice spherical thing, it's just, you know, it's got all kinds of structure to it. That's, you know, the explosion residue. And at the center, you know, that mother sphere they're talking about, we call that thing at the center, the Crab Nebula, a neutron star. And it's a pulsar. We see it, you know, flashing. When we talked about that earlier, you know, so a lot of this material got, you know, shredded into ultimatons, you know, and went flying off out into space. Some of it just, you know, blew it apart like a, you know, like a regular explosion, and there's debris, you know, and a cloud all around it. But some of it, you know, is that core that had condensed down in the middle, you know, which is kind of like an ultimatonic crystal. You know, it isn't actually a ball of billiard ball neutrons like we think it is. You know, it's this very dense system of motion that's kind of like a giant ultimatonic crystal. Okay, and it's a very high energy phenomenon, so it produces all kinds of massive consequences within that nebula that we've begun to measure in all sorts of different wavelengths now, you know, and have all kinds of information about. So what they're doing there is saying, yeah, all that stuff, especially now in the 21st century that you have about the Crab Nebula, it definitely was a single star that exploded. You're not going to understand some things about it because you're trying to rationalize it with your current stellar interior theories and things like that. You know, one of the things that they can't figure out is, and they total up the mass of the what they think is a neutron star and the mass of the cloud of material in the nebula. It's not enough mass, you know, and so there's all these issues like this. But like we remember we mentioned, stars go on for trillions of years, you know, and stars over that time, just with a normal solar stellar wind, you know, drift off gobs and gobs of material, and seeing that would be all long gone, wouldn't be anywhere near that vicinity. And there's all these issues that they don't understand, let alone they're trying to have enough mass to make their billiard ball model work. And see, none of that is actually going on. And see, so that all these, they're trying to give you a point to that. It's like, you can study that a lot. It's pretty close. You can study it in great detail. Continue to study it and leverage off of the things that we've given you here and see if you can slowly zero in on what actually happened. You know, use your information from the Andromeda one. Use the one from 1987 in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Obviously, they couldn't talk about here. That hadn't happened yet. Use these close on things, you know, and notice that when you try to rationalize them, there's always an issue. I've told you about that one in the Large Magellanic Cloud. When they saw the supernova go off, and then they went back and looked at old photographs to see what star blew up, and it was a star that wasn't supposed to be able to blow up. You know, but a week later, they tweaked their model, and then, you know, then it could blow up. Right? So saying, yeah, see, there's a simple example. Notice that your current model, you know, doesn't have any predictive power. Every time you actually make an observation, it doesn't agree. You know, it's because it's all confused. You know, you've got all kinds of huge issues. You don't know the primary energy generation mechanism. You know nothing of the state of matter that's in the interior of stars. You don't even have the correct fusion, you know, as the predominant fusion mechanism, because you think their stars are too cold, and on this goes. Okay. That's the kind of stuff they're doing, and they do it by using human source works and tweaking them, and using our thoughts and saying them in curious ways, and you know, all these subtle suggestive things that take what they're saying right up to the boundaries of the revelation mandate, and not one inch further, and we have to take it the rest of the way. The revelation can never be more than half the picture. Like, let's say you're trying to understand the life and teachings of Jesus. Do you know that what's in part four is only half of what you need to properly understand the life and teachings of Jesus? The other half is in the Bible and historical records and stuff. And if you're trying to make a consistent picture with just part four, you're going to be totally messed up. You have to bring in human philosophy for the other half of the picture. You can't just use the revelation. You know, it's at most the upper hemisphere. It doesn't give you the lower hemisphere of the full picture. Okay, this is very, very important. And there's endless examples of people not appreciating that, you know, not taking into account what it says in the New Testament when they interpret, you know, what's in part four. Think, well, you just reject the Old Testament. It's all overruled by part four. No, it isn't. It's augmented by part four. And if you don't know the Old Testament, you're going to misinterpret part four. Okay? You're going to get confused about the Pentecost issue. And there's all kinds of things like this that you'll be confused about if you try to just base it on this. It's true for everything in the book. If you don't have everything that humans can bring to bear, you're going to be suffering in your efforts to understand what's going on in the revelation. All right, let's take a moment here.